I came from kind of an academic background, and I'm like, I suddenly have 18 employees, and it's just a nightmare. And all I was doing was HR stuff, and I really just wanted to be programming.
Ever wish somebody had written the book on making mobile app businesses work? Wish no more. The job has been done. Hello and welcome to Growth Masterminds. My name is John Kutzer. The mobile app business, we all know, it's pretty crazy, right? So much jargon, so much to learn, so much that's always changing. Have to relearn 30% of what you learn every year. Wouldn't it be nice if somebody put it all down in some place that you could look through it all and you give the newbie something to look at so they can get up to speed and you could discreetly check on all the stuff that you're supposed to know, but you forgot or you didn't ever learn in the first place? Well, Russell Ovens is director of analytics at Eastside Games. He's also an entrepreneur. He's a computer scientist. He's a college professor, owned a brewery, started, and he has quite literally written the book on mobile. It's called Game Analytics, Retention and Monetization in Free-to-Play Mobile Games. And we're going to chat about it. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hey, super pumped to have you. Looking forward to chatting about this, including all the stuff in there. We'll go through it. I'm going to show it right here. You sent me a copy. It's pretty cool. It's got all the stuff there. But before we dive into the book, walk us through your journey in mobile games and maybe being a brewery owner.
The less said about that, the better. So my journey to mobile games actually started in social gaming in 2007 when I'd like to say I accidentally founded a social game company in Victoria, BC called Backstage Technologies. And it was when in 2007, earlier that year, Facebook opened up its platform to third-party developers. And I had this boutique software engineering firm, and we were writing a day trading software for, fintech people down in the Silicon Valley. And we wanted to have our own products and services. So I said, let's write a simple game and for Facebook. I didn't think of it as a game. It was actually the first thing we wrote was Scratch and Win. And it was a way to gift people scratch tickets because I firmly believed in that people are, what do they like to do? People like to buy lottery tickets. So we built a little app that did that. And my team were younger than me, and they'd all grown up with like World of Warcraft and these other things, and they knew how to gamify it. And before I knew it, we had this roaring success. And in 2008, we completely pivoted out of contract software engineering, and we're a full-time social game studio, one of the very first to...
So much more interesting than contracts.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I kind of preferred what I was doing. I am a terrible games person because, the industry found me. I didn't chase it, which is whatever. And it turns out, like, whenever I'm actually quite good at it, I guess, is the nice thing. But it's not like my big passion in life was, gaming and that. You know, like, I grew up with an Atari console and did all that stuff, but very quickly, like, lost my interest in games. But then fell right back into it. And what I loved about those early days of social gaming was it was the Wild West. And we were making it up as we went, and Facebook would change the rules and overnight just like kill organic growth of your game. And then, different monetization partners would come and go. So there was an offer wall company called Super Rewards back in those days. And there were two, Super Rewards and OfferPal, and they were like the two big competitors. And Super Rewards was run by a guy named Jason Bailey out of Vancouver, and I was his first customer, my game studio. So that's how I ended up back in mobile gaming, and in particular, how I ended up at Eastside Games is that our CEO is Jason Bailey, same guy who started Super Rewards.
Yeah.
So in 2010, I sold Backstage to Real Networks. And again, because
I'm in Seattle, Real Network.
They had their game house division, and it was a game house that bought it effectively.
Right.
And by then we'd grown our kind of casual games to include Family Feud. We built a Family Feud app on Facebook. You probably played it. Just about everybody on the planet did. And like we had like over 1 million daily active users and 2 cent ARPDAU. That was the that was the industry back then, right?
Yeah.
And it was really stressful for me. And like I said, this wasn't my real passion. I came from kind of an academic background, and I'm like, I suddenly have 18 employees, and it's just a nightmare. And all I was doing was HR stuff, and I really just wanted to be programming. And so I sold it, and and immediately left the industry. You know, and
let's pause there for just a second, because it's interesting to reflect back on that time in gaming. I mean, Facebook gaming, Facebook as a platform for gaming was a thing. It was a big thing before mobile gaming was a big thing. And it's interesting. I mean, echoes of Farmville, right? You know, your crops need to be tended, all that stuff. It's interesting. Facebook shut that down because their bigger opportunity was in social and all the stuff that they went into. But it's kind of interesting to think about if Facebook had found a way to keep that going while doing their other stuff, the history of mobile gaming might have evolved in a very different direction than
And we're talking, this was only 13 years ago. 14 years ago, I guess, now that we're in 2024. And Facebook was the biggest gaming platform in the world. And they didn't want to be.
No. I know. They couldn't figure out how to monetize that really well.
Well, they didn't. Okay, so then they brought trial pay on as the offer wall that you had to use, and they took 30% of that. Like, they started to do all the things that ultimately Apple and Google did in mobile.
Right.
But ultimately, they just didn't like all that crap in the newsfeed. I mean, they could have just made it so if you have a game, you can't post in the newsfeed, right?
But yeah,
and they kind of did. They kind of did. They kept tweaking it, and like literally overnight, bankrupting certain game studios who relied on certain, you know, mechanics, because there wasn't a lot going on in user acquisition.
Yes.
Right. We dabbled in it a little bit, and it was really hard to get a ROAS. And
organic was huge.
Organic
was huge, like you say, because it was in the feed, so people would see it. And of course, it polluted the feed. And so, if you weren't into gaming, then you're like, I don't care about your bloody crops or your family feud or whatever. And so, Facebook saw what they thought was a bigger opportunity. They're probably right at some level, but probably also wrong at some level.
Well, I think it worked out just fine for them. I'm not losing any sleep. But it's funny when I came back to mobile in 2018, I came back to work in the industry, and it was, I wanted to work with Jason Bailey, and he had this studio in Vancouver, Eastside Games, and they put out Trailer Park Boys, and it was a mobile title the year before, and it was doing really well. And he wanted my analytics insight to come in and help with that, you know. And I'm like, I'd been out of the industry for 8 years. I didn't really know what I was doing, but nothing really had changed in terms of what we were measuring and how we were doing it. The thing that had changed was that you didn't really have many users, but boy, did they monetize a lot better. I'm serious. Like, you know, you'd have a game on Facebook, 1 million daily active users, 2 cent ARPDAU, right?
Oh.
And then you go to like Eastside Games and you got 100,000 daily active users, but $1 ARPDAU, you know, okay. I'd still have a company if I would never have sold Backstage if we'd, you know, been able to, you know, manage that kind of monetization. So.
Somewhere there is an alternate reality where Facebook figured it out and there was monetization and user acquisition, and the games industry evolved in a totally different way. In any case, you came back to the industry, you took some time in different places. You went and you taught at college, you built a brewery. You said the less said about that, the better. So I'm guessing that's kind of like a boat, you know, where you might as well just take $100 bills and burn them.
Yeah. like one of those classic, you know, cases of hubris of the tech entrepreneur. I can do anything. I started a successful tech company and I exited, and now I'm work optional. So I can go do, I'm going to solve every problem that, you know, I know nothing about, because, you know, and so I'd always wanted to, I was very interested in the whole craft beer movement. And yeah, I went and scratched that itch and, you know, lit a pile of money on fire and sold it 2 years ago and have moved on. It's a good story for the grandkids, I guess, ultimately.
So you came back to Eastside Games, yep, and you were doing some analytics for them. What's going on? What's happening? Where are our users? How are we retaining? How are we monetizing? Mm-hmm. Where are we monetizing best? What's working? What's not working? And as you did all that stuff and kind of re-immersed yourself back in the industry and then maybe even learned some of the mobile stuff that maybe you didn't have to deal with in the previous company, you started looking at all the things that I assume are on your topic list here. There's ROAS, there's dashboards, there's modeling, predicting, LTV curves, churn, A/B testing, improving retention, optimizing your pricing. That's an interesting one. All that stuff. When did you think I need to write a book about this?
Well, I mean, fairly early on, and the reason is because I guess my background as an academic and an instructor, I love learning and I love teaching, and so I just thought it was a real opportunity to put down on paper all like you alluded to it in the intro, all the things I wish I knew when I'd come back in the industry in 2018, because we would be asked to do something and we would go off and think about it and muddle around and make a mess of it and come back with something that was kind of right. And then have this breakthrough and then solve it and then realize, oh, that's just the way everyone else does it. When you start talking to other people, right? And I'm like, well, where can I go to get this information? And then I think it was like a year or two in that I discovered Eric Seufert's book, Freemium Economics. And I went back and I read it and I'm like, oh, okay, well, most of the ideas are here. There's just none of the actual detail about how you do it.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And so my book is kind of like the 300 page addendum to Freemium Economics that says, oh, by the way, this is how you calculate and build a retention curve, which is kind of the foundational piece, right? And then from there, you can look at its flip side, which is the monetization curve. And from that, the monetization curve, you can then predict ROAS from early signals. And away you go, you're off to the races.
Exactly. So by the way, if you do happen to pick up the book, there is actual code, there's SQL, there's how to build it in, how to build your dashboards in Tableau, if you're going to use Tableau, all that stuff. So there's a lot of help there. There's a lot of code there. And obviously all need to be adapted to your particular environment and everything like that, but at least a starting place for that, which is super helpful.
Yeah. And the code, one of the first things I did when I started at Eastside Games was it was the first time I'd worked with like a data warehouse, and it was in Amazon Redshift. And, I had to get used to the fact that there's no referential integrity between the tables, right? And the data's a mess. And it's all just coming in and there's no like stopping to think about well, what does that mean for this user? How long have they been playing the game? What day is this? Which days did they play leading up to this moment in their evolution? How much money have they spent? All those things, right? And so what I did was I created a set of views, and a view is just like a stored SQL query. Mm-hmm. And I created effectively my own schema on top of the Amazon Redshift data warehouse. And this is, I think, largely because I come from a very traditional computer science background. I'm a software engineer by training, the third normal form was, like a big part of my education and how you build data-driven systems. And so I created my own sort of abstract schema on top of the mess. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I introduced that as we go through the book, and anybody can do that. Anybody can take their own data warehouse then. And I think it's a good idea for people to do that because, during my time at Eastside Games, we acquired at least one or two other games, and we would get the data and it would be just a freaking mess, right? And it would be so much data. But the same ideas apply. If you have an abstract model of how you want to look at a user, and really that's all you care about. You care about your users. Mm-hmm. And so each user would have effectively a normalized view of their retention and their monetization behavior since they installed the game. And so I developed that. So yeah, there's a lot of SQL in the book, and you can skip over it if you're not into that kind of thing. But if you are, one of the things you might want to take away from it is the power of building an abstract schema on top of your data warehouse by creating these stored views. And we and materialize them in order to get, you know, the performance when your game scales to like the heights of a game like Trailer Park Boys, which has, you know, millions and millions and millions of rows of data.
It makes tons of sense to me, right? I mean, because you're capturing almost everything, you dump it in a warehouse, right? It's pretty unstructured. But to make sense of that, you kind of have to impose a sense of at least order and structure as to how you see things. And in terms of users, as you were talking about, it makes a ton of sense to me, not being a data scientist, but having been an analyst and having to go back and forth like 5, 6, 7 times on some queries sometimes because, oh, we found something interesting, wasn't what I wanted. Oh, we found something interesting, also not what we wanted. Yeah, that can get challenging. And I remember in a sharded database, spending about $7,000 to get data that I needed.
Yeah, you know, that can happen. I mean, as it is, I mean, we're, you know, running queries against our production database. It probably shouldn't be, you know, just from a cost and a performance standpoint.
Let's get into a couple tidbits, let's say. Page 254, you talk about iOS pricing versus Android pricing for in-app purchases and how you can never let Apple determine your iOS pricing for, let's say, non-North American or non-Western European countries. Talk about why.
Well, we do let Apple. It's Google you shouldn't let.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I got it wrong.
Right. I mean, no, they both do it. And they both are typically all they do is, you know, so you register a SKU in the App Store or the Play Store and you say, okay, I want it to be $4.99 US. And you do that. And then the platforms go ahead and say, oh, okay, well, that should be $6.99 in Canada because the exchange rate today is, you know, is pretty terrible. And on it goes through all the different geos where
Ethiopia, Niger.
Yeah. And all they do is they apply the prevailing exchange rate. And Apple will occasionally update prices if the exchange rates fluctuate too much, but Google never will. So once you do that, they're set in stone unless you go in and say refresh the exchange rates. Google also has the ability to export your prices as a CSV and then make modifications by country and then upload the CSV again, and it'll go ahead and so you can override the exchange rate mechanic. What we discovered is that exchange rates are really bad at capturing relative purchasing power between consumers in different countries. And this came to my attention because we knew our monetization was bad for let's look at, say, Trailer Park Boys. You know, it's a popular TV show in Canada, semi-popular in a few other countries around the world. It's on Netflix. So, you know, if you're English speaking and the game is very, you know, narrative driven, it's got episodes in it and it's, you know, so we figured it wasn't doing well in, say, Mexico because it wasn't localized into Spanish. But really, it was that our prices were too high. You know, so we had a new assistant producer join the studio, Viviana Ramos. And she was from Mexico City. And she came over to my desk and she said, these prices are ridiculous. And in Mexico, no one's ever going to, you know, make a purchase. And so we looked at that. And I came up with this idea again. Not original. Many, many economists and business people or international marketers have thought about this. It's how many hours of labor does it take the consumer to earn enough money to make that purchase? And that should be the same across all the jurisdictions in which you're trying to sell this commodity.
It's like the Big Mac Index or
something. Yeah, the Big Mac Index, which I use in the book, isn't, spoiler, it's not the best. approach. It's good. It's a great starting point, but then you do want to use A/B testing on top of that to dial it in. But what we did was we took advantage of the fact that Google provided this mechanism to do bulk pricing changes. And I wrote a program that applied, purchasing power parity ideals in addition to the exchange rate and in addition to the fact that value-added taxes are included in the price in the rest of the world. Canada and the U.S. are outliers in that regard. So ended up updating our prices, and we started as a test. We looked at Mexico. We used that as a test bed, and sure enough, we started to see better conversion and better retention. A converted player is likely to stick around. And for existing players, the ARPDAU went up. They were making purchases, whereas they had been playing the game for months and had never made a purchase. Suddenly they did. Well, maybe it's because they suddenly think that, spending 3 hours of their labor as a barista in Guadalajara is, not worth it. But if it's 15 minutes, yeah, I'll make that purchase. Same as someone in Canada or the U.S. would. And then we also changed all of our Canadian prices to be on parity with the U.S. So that $4.99 U.S. SKU became $4.99 in Canada. It was still $6.99 on Apple, but we didn't care about Apple. Because if you are a Canadian with an iOS device, you're probably less price sensitive than the consumer, the cheap ass running around with an Android device they bought for $49 at the kiosk in City Square Mall, right? Mm-hmm. So we didn't touch Apple for two reasons. They make it difficult. They've started to make changes where you can fiddle with that now, I've seen. But it wasn't easy to make wholesale changes the way you can with Google. And also, I didn't think it was as imperative. Oh, and also because their market reach around the world is not nearly that great. Right? Most people in other geos, India, Brazil, et cetera, they're on Android devices. Very few of them are on iOS relative, like their market share just is the same. So you don't get as much bang for the buck there.
Super interesting. Let's turn to A/B testing. You've got an entire chapter on that. That is something that, sorry, say again.
Two chapters. I introduce the whole, I give all the theory and then I apply it to the mobile games. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. That is something that at the outset, everybody thinks, great idea. Let's do that. Wonderful. Awesome. We'll learn what's best, what works. And it's also an idea that at the outset seems pretty simple. Run a test, pick the one that performs better, go with it. In reality, it's horrifically complex to the level that there's people who argue that most of the A/B tests, never mind multivariate tests that are done globally, are done wrong, and people make the wrong decisions and do the wrong things. Let's talk about that.
I would agree, and based on experience, when I joined Eastside Games, we weren't doing any A/B testing because we didn't need to. On one hand, like success. Hey,
we're making money.
Yeah, exactly. And then over time, we expand. We got 240 employees now, and we're publicly traded. We got to hit our targets, and then suddenly it's all like, my God, we got to take A/B testing seriously. We got to integrate Swerve in this one or use Firebase, and first of all, using those tools is complicated. It's not like two lines of code that you add into the client and away you go. So there's that complexity. It can be expensive if you're using third-party tools to do your user segmentation and push different pricing or whatever it is that you're testing, different color icon or whatever. And then what I found is that evaluating the results is a lot of people just don't know what they're doing, and me included, right? And so I had an analyst that was working for me, Jess Simkin. She was great, and she knew all about Bayesian analysis. And I left all that to her, and she ran with it, and I trusted her. And then I sat down to write this book, and I'm like, oh God, I didn't want to teach myself, Bayesian statistics. I'd learned frequentist statistics in 1984. It's part of my undergraduate degree in computer science at the University of Victoria. And I did really well in it. And I remember I loved it. And I still had my textbook. I dug out my textbook and I taught myself statistics again. Mm-hmm. And then figured it all out well enough that I could teach it, right? Like in order to write about something, you really have to. And it was the chapter that took me the longest and the most iterations to get right. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably the most proud of it, of all of the pieces of the book, because I really do think, to your point, there's a real deficit in our industry about how to do it correctly. And in particular, what kind of tests you can actually do in a reasonable amount of time and have enough power in the calculation. So I go into great detail about how, before you run a test, what it is exactly you're measuring, what's the difference that you're looking to detect as being significant, and thus, these are the number of people that need to be in your test and control group in order to be reasonably sure. And I give an example of how we ran an A/B test to see whether introducing banner ads into Trailer Park Boys would be a good idea or not. You know, our CEO, Jason, was like, oh, we got to get banner ads in the team. You know, we're leaving money on the table, blah, blah, blah. Just do it. And we're like, no, maybe we should A/B test it first because we're afraid it's going to lead to churn. Like people are going to see the ads and think, ah, I don't, that's dumb, and leave. Mm-hmm. So we ran a test and the test said, no, it didn't affect retention or monetization. So great, we rolled it out. Then we botched the rollout and then had to turn it off. And then 6 months later, we returned to the and did another A/B test because I'm like, okay, I think I know how to do A/B testing a little better. Jess had moved on to EA where she's, you know, setting the world on fire. So I didn't have my trusty analyst to do my analysis for me. And I went and looked at it and said, well, we didn't have the right power originally. We were making the determination that there was no effect of introducing banner ads, but our sample sizes were too small. Mm-hmm. We ran the test again, and they definitely said, don't put banner ads in this game. So, So again, our knowledge of how to do that continues to evolve. And it's a real, it is a bit of electrified water to wade into. If you, so really, you know, make sure you're clear on what you're measuring, what you consider to be significant. And do you have enough users in your samples to make a determination? Now with Bayesian, you can start to make a determination immediately, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of one of the advantages of Bayesian statistics. But I don't understand fully how it does that. It's all magic to me. So
there's something to be said for only doing things that you fully understand.
Absolutely.
Because a little knowledge is a dangerous thing.
Yeah, it's like at my age, you know, like I know people like to program with Python, but I'm like, that's not, you know, that I'll just fire up Java or, you know, I'll use something I'm very, you know, comfortable with. I don't need awesome. To. I don't need
if anybody, by the way, is watching me while Russell is talking. I'm usually in a little corner here and I'm coughing my lungs out. That's because I'm quite sick. So I'm carefully muting myself whenever possible and try not to wreck the podcast here. But anyways, that's super interesting. Hopefully some of the tools that you mentioned as well, some of the other tools that are out there for A/B testing will incorporate elements of Bayesian statistics so that you can get your data quicker and easier. And they will hopefully also encourage you, if not mandate, that you have big enough sample sizes so that you cannot shoot yourself in the foot. Mm-hmm. But I think it's possible with most tools to shoot yourself in the foot and sometimes even in the head. So it is good to be careful about that. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about retention. You've got a chapter on that. I think it's one, not two. Correct me if I'm wrong. You've got a chapter.
There's one on how you build the retention curve. There's one on how you improve retention.
Oh, man. So many chapters. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's...
Or levels as you've got yes. it, which is good for a gamified sort of book.
That's like a damage.
Talk about boosting retention. What have you learned in that? Any minefields, any gotchas that you've discovered?
The main thing that we use for evaluating early retention, because everything kind of hinges off D1, is the Fatui funnel. So the first time user experience funnel and our first four levels of say any of our idle games are full of milestones that players achieve. you know, like level one will have like 12, 13, 14 things that they do in order. And then we build a funnel looking at, okay, well, over this period of time, and it's usually by version of the app. So we'll release a new version of the client, and we'll look at the user journey for all of the installs using that version. And say they start with, like, we get 10,000 over 2 weeks, something like that. And out of those 10,000, 9,500 make it through milestone one. 9,300 make it through milestone two, right? And so it's not really a funnel. It's more like a fence that's, you know, falling more slowly. And at the end of it, out pops basically your D1 retention number, or close to it. If you make it through the Fatui funnel, you're probably playing on D1. And that analysis is really good at indicating two things. One, where friction in the early game play is too much, and the player is just like, I'm not invested in this enough yet. I haven't seen enough. I haven't been introduced to anything that's really a great dopamine, you know, experience. So, you know, away it goes. I got too many other things to do, or a technical issue, and that technical issue can be bugs that cause crashing on certain devices, low memory devices typically, or suddenly where the game needs to download a bunch of assets. And it's like, oh, you know, to continue playing, you know, download, you know, 200
loading.
And first of all, if they're on, you know, they're not on Wi-Fi, maybe they don't want to do it. And again, going back to, like, you know, the rest of the world, not everyone has, you know, bandwidth connections. Some people are paying for their data, so they don't want to do that. And it just becomes a reason not to continue. And we saw that immensely with The Office, one of the games we developed. Somehow we managed the idle version of The Office game that we built. That there was a point in the Fatui where, you know, we asked people to download assets, and it was a big churn point. So that's the main, you know, that's like you should at least be doing as a game studio. It's just not that difficult to build. It's not that difficult to instrument. It's a lot of data you have to collect, but it's really, really important data you can then use to kind of like diagnose. It's a diagnostic approach. It's like, okay, we see something's broken here because we're losing 5% of our players at this one milestone. And why is that?
Yeah. That also speaks to architecting your game experience, especially the early stages of game experience, in a certain way to be able to capture that data, right? It's not just totally unstructured. Hey, run through, do whatever you want to do. There's actual things.
Yeah. I think that a lot, you see that with a lot of mobile games. Like there's no, you don't read the rules. They just show you press here now, do this. And then they hope you figure out what the objective of the game is, right? And in a game that takes too long to kind of get to the fun or the objective, you know, that's definitely, you know, potentially a problem. So, you know, and there's that famous Adam Carpenter talk, the Google guy, about, you know, your first correlating minutes played on D0 to D1 retention. And, you know, I talk about that in the book too, and show quite clearly that in a couple of our games, it's our D0 experience is not optimal. It takes too long for players to get to the point where they really get it, and they want to keep playing, and they've given up for whatever myriad of reasons before then. So, you know, that's whole first time experience is really, really crucial.
I've always felt there should be a metric, taps to fun. How many taps does it take before you're actually enjoying yourself? And that might be interesting. Maybe let's hit one more. You've also got a chapter on ROAS, which seems like one of those super simple things. How much did I spend on ads? How much did I get back? And again, as you delve into it, it's not as simple as it looks.
Well, the concept is as simple as you.
Yeah, the concept is.
Yeah, ROAS is just the ratio of LTV to cost.
Like world peace. Everybody understands the concept.
Yeah. The issue really is how quickly can you tell whether a campaign that you're running, so you're usually running many campaigns simultaneously, different ad networks, you know, lots of ad networks, lots of campaigns in each ad network. And then every day you look at the data and you say, okay, well, this campaign is predicted to break even in this number of days, this one and this, you know. And it's based on this number of installs, right? Mm-hmm. And usually not enough installs to be really, you know, like, it's a very wide confidence interval in terms of like the LTV prediction and the days to break even. So that's where it becomes, you know, a bit tricky, is really being sure you're, first of all, you have to have models of how your game's monetization curve looks that are pretty robust and hopefully based on, you know, the last 90, 180 days of installs, fully baked installs. Mm-hmm. So the last group of people that played had the opportunity to play a full 90 days or a full 180 days. So really, your game has to have been live and driving a lot of installs for 6 months before you really have a clear, I believe, picture of how the game ultimately monetizes. And you can then use that to do pretty accurate predictions and much more so than doing like on the spot predictions of an individual campaign, mm-hmm. right? Based on the first 7, 14, 30 days of users, where you try to extrapolate their monetization or extrapolate their retention and ARPDAU. You're a bit better off saying, okay, this is where they are now. And based on what we know about the retention curve, we know that they're 33% into how much they're going to have spent by day 90 or 25% by day 180 or whatever. And then you just extrapolate from that. And then there's a pretty straightforward days to break even calculation that I introduce. Not straightforward. Yeah. It's pretty ugly looking formula, but, and that is something, again, I learned while writing this book. Is we used to do that somehow. One of my colleagues, Francois, used to calculate it. I don't know how he was doing it, but I actually figured out, here's a formula for it, you know, based mm-hmm. on what the shape of the monetization curve looks like and what you've seen so far by day. And you can then extrapolate as to how many days it's going to break even based on a CPI for the cohort.
Super interesting. And we'll have to call it here. There's 50,000 more things that I'd love to chat about, but I will say one other thing that what I've really enjoyed is, and I haven't read it word for word, but I have skimmed through a lot of it. What I really enjoyed is that you wrote it with some humor. I'm going to give an example for people here. I'm happen to be on page 201. And you're talking about LTV, and you're saying, if we look at ongoing LTV uncapped by any days since install, we definitely see those iOS payers in the US spending like drunk data scientists at a Python conference in Las Vegas. It's much easier to read something when it's enjoyable, when somebody's having fun writing it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really, really good. I will say this. I think that this is super useful. It's super useful if somebody's new in the industry. I think it's super useful for people who aren't even at a mobile games publisher or studio. Maybe you're in the industry in some other way and you just came into the industry. Maybe you're with an ad network or something like that. And you're wondering, what the heck are all these people talking about? If you want to talk the language, you don't have to look at all of the formulas. You can just read through here and you'll get a good sense of what's going on in the space, what people care about, what you need to know. I think it's a great job. Well done. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks, John. I really appreciate the kind words and that you didn't take offense to my editorial.
Not in the least. Wonderful. Russell, thank you so much for this time. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.